The Book of Revelation and other ancient apocalypses portray visions and prophecies that spoke to the moment of their times. Their language and imagery depicted the divine power that promises to deliver audiences from the powerful, often imperial, oppression they endured. These apocalypses are both violent and hopeful, violent for the oppressors and hopeful for the oppressed. Our guest today, Harvard Divinity School Professor Giovanni Bazzana, helps us to understand this dynamic at a deeper level, but he also discusses later activations of apocalypses, including in today's world. What happens to this complex ancient literature in these activations? Do the oppressed become the oppressors? And do the powerful convince themselves that they are persecuted? And what is lost over the ages when we see the spectacle and theatricality of apocalyptic imagery in popular culture? Professor Bazzana unpacks this rich cultural dynamic and also muses about the place of spirit possession in the study of ancient Christianity. Hi, I'm your host, Steve Ahern Kroll, and this is the Future of the Past Lab, the podcast where we rethink the legacies of injustice in the study of antiquity. Well, welcome, Giovanni. And I thought we would start with kind of a basic question about your background. So can you tell us how you came to the study of early Christianity and what keeps you interested in it?
Thank you, Steve, for having me. Sure. This is an interesting question. I have a very unusual path to this because I'm Italian. And I grew up in Italy. I was trained in Italy. I started being interested in, some background. I was a very, very good Catholic growing up. When I went to school, I did enroll in classics as an undergraduate. And I, as a very good Catholic in Italy, I didn't know anything about even the existence of the study, critical study of the Bible or early Christian history, right?
Yeah.
And so I encountered that as a, you know, very much by chance because I had to take one of these complementary classes while I was an undergraduate. And since I was religiously motivated, I said, oh, there's a class on early Christian history. I mean, I may learn something. And I signed up for that. I think it was in my sophomore year. And this was a shocking encounter with the fact that there was actually a critical, philologically based, historical, critical study of not only of the Bible, but also early Christian history. Italy has a stronger tradition, perhaps, in what is was called patristics, more so than biblical study, per se. So it was mostly really historical and patristics, and I got very interested in apocryphal gospels or apocryphal texts that were not included in the New Testament. So that was my first foray, kind of hooked me up, especially because, you know, I was majoring in classics, but I felt that this was new, right? It was something that I never heard of. I mean, I had a lot of experience with, you know, classics, Greek and Latin literature already from high school. This is the Italian system.
Right.
But this was really new, really, really got me. And also, if you are ruined a little bit my religious life, as it often happens with this, whoever enters this field. So I got into that, and at first it was existentially very interesting, very, very, you know, it raised profound questions for me about, you know, my religious life, et cetera. I went through a phase many people go through, many also friends and colleagues go through, like, you know, becoming very critical of, especially the Catholic Church in this case, which I still am. But I have to say, through the years, I've kind of come around a little bit. I see scholarship in this field not as much as, you know, a tool for dismantling dogmas or certain doctrines I don't like in the church. But as actually I see it more like, sometimes a critical tool for sure. But also a way to talk about this great dimension, this very important dimension of our life, which is, you know, our religious experience, and that we we should make part, I see this as a tool to make it part of academic discourse, academic conversations, which is not easy because I feel like this is, even among the humanities, is a tricky field to kind of bake into the rest of the humanities. So what keeps me hooked at this point is exactly this. I think it is, especially this day and age, not only in this country, but globally, I think the importance of religion and the importance of having a critical, well-grounded study of religion is goes well beyond the churches of individual religious experience. It's really a matter of political, cultural import. And I find that fascinating. And hopefully it can also contribute something to social... social causes and social and political discourses. I don't know if I really do that, but I think it matters. That's what I like.
Yeah, I find in my own teaching that there's this strange contrast between teaching undergraduates and graduate students. Because in graduate students, it's very much trying to, you know, get them to move beyond their critical perspective and see, as you were saying, see the religious experience of religion, you know, in a critical way, but something that needs to be acknowledged. With my undergraduates, it's just the opposite. Where you want to say, that's enough religious experience. We get it. And then now let's look at something else that might help you understand this a little bit better. So it's an interesting pairing.
Yeah, these students are very two different stages of their path in this. I do that a lot. I feel that a lot, especially teaching in a divinity school, which is set up a little bit different, I think, than here.
Yeah.
And having often classes where I have these two groups of students sitting together.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, sometimes awkward, not so much. It's actually a fascinating encounter to be had because, you know, each group teaches a little bit something to the other, or you can after a while, I've learned that I can use reactions of one group to kind of stimulate the other and vice versa.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not... Yeah, it's complicated, but actually, it does, you know, that is a good way to confirm that this matters.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So, in your own work and in my field, we share the same field, and over the years, I've noticed that there's a domination by many biblical scholars for just doing literary work, looking at the text very, very closely, but almost strictly in a literary sense. Can you tell us what your approach is in comparing literature, both the contemporary literature and contemporary social and cultural data? So how do you both attend to the literary, but also kind of expand your horizons beyond the literary as well?
Yeah, so going back to, I mean, the analysis is certainly right. I mean, our field is traditionally and still kind of dominated by textual approaches for sure. I think this is changing a little bit, and this is good to see. It's in my opinion, it's also kind of the way in which the field protects itself from kind of, it's always been a little isolationist, I think, and very traditional in the way to do things. But this kind of refusal to open up is also a way to protect its identity. So that's on one hand is understandable, on the other hand is untenable, especially now that the changing ecosystem of higher education, not only here but elsewhere as well, is gonna force this to change anyway.
Right.
What I do personally, so I was trained, going back to the first question, I was trained very much in this textual tradition. I was a major in classics, as I said, I was actually more, I've always been more interested in historical and in the history of the ancient world and Roman history especially, than in the philological work per se. That has always been, and probably that has kind of made it easier for me to think, let's put it this way, outside the box of traditional New Testament studies, for instance. But then again, as I said, my first significant interest in the field was texts that were not included in the canon of the New Testament, so-called apocryphal texts. So it was textual. But through the years, I've realized that if we are committed, going back to the isolationism, point, if we are committing to really change the discipline in a way that actually shows, especially the voices of those, I don't know, thinking about early Christianity now, especially those who were members of this early Christ movement, but were not the people who could write and leave us textual evidence. Yeah. And we know these was these people are actually the majority of the adherents to these groups in the beginning and probably throughout the centuries. I mean, they've always been the majorities. Now I'm talking about, I don't know, women with respect to men or people of different social classes than those who, you know, that we know from the study of the ancient world that only people of a certain very high social class could produce the textual, the literature we have that cuts out not just people who were enslaved, but even people who were not enslaved but didn't have the means for education, for literally simply learning how to write or read. Yeah. So if we are committed, and I am, to actually write or study the history of this early Christ movement fully in a way that doesn't only focus on the kind of relatively small group of people who actually have written the literary texts that we that have been preserved to us, or the most of them, we need to actually go beyond just the text. Not, and I'm not talking only the text included in the canon of the New Testament, you know, generally speaking. And so my, you know, early on, my interest in this was through papyrology, because when I was an undergraduate, that was kind of my, as a major in class, that was kind of my secondary field, if one wants. And it was that was the first way I actually began to open up this because I focused on documentary papyrology, and that's actually is one way to see these lives of people whose record is otherwise not included in the literary archive. Another way is working more with material culture. This is something you know very well, because it is another way to actually have the possibility of hearing or being these other voices. I think I would, to answer your question, I would say that this was guiding me kind of to integrate these archives that are normally, because of traditional disciplinary boundaries, they are separated. It's been, you know, kind of an effort to open them up and, and put them into conversation. It's a little tricky, of course, because these various disciplinary fields have their own conventions, their own scholarly practices, and one has to kind of become familiar with them. And some of them, or all of them, I would say, are kind of a little protective of their own traditions and don't like. I mean, we all speak about doing interdisciplinary work, but then, you know, when we do it, usually when we meet someone who's doing it, we criticize a little bit are doing on our side.
Yes.
but it's rewarding because, like I said, you know, it allows us, if we are interested in historical and kind of reconstructing this history in a way that's more open and actually deeper, I would say, and in the long run also more meaningful, thinking also about contemporary concerns, definitely we need to do that.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there's been a huge push at our university for interdisciplinary work in CLA, and it was really kind of billed as this is the wave of the future and we need to talk to each other and everything. I think it was a budget cutting thing. Because, you know, if you're doing interdisciplinary work, you don't need any more than one person.
Yeah, you don't have to hire anyone in the other field because you're already doing it.
But it's been really great as well. My previous job was at a theological school as well. And and it was, you know, a very small faculty and very focused on preparing people for ministry and a few people going on for graduate school, but mainly people preparing for ministry. But we hardly talked to each other, even though we were all studying Christianity in different ways. And then since I've been here, it's much more dialogic, you know, people across, literally across
that
disciplines.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it's learning from people who are sociologists or historians or classicists in our department. And so it's just opened up a whole different way of thinking of my own discipline and how I approach the New Testament and early Christianity. And it's it's been very fruitful in many ways, and especially the material culture part. That is just really fascinating.
Yeah.
I was in a session at the Society for Biblical Literature conference a couple of years ago, and we had, you know, a panel of talks, but then about a 45-minute conversation after the talks, and it was people just going back and forth with really great insights. And somebody stopped and said, "This is a really great conversation because we're seeing how studying material culture gives you a level of immediacy that textual work doesn't, because there's so many things you have to do to interpret and figure out what they're actually saying, who they're saying it to, and who said it, and all that. And the material world can be, it doesn't have to be, but it can be much more immediate to the religious world.
Yeah, I think all, I mean, I'm not saying that these are the, I mean, of course, these fields like material culture, papyrology are traditionally closer, allied fields, if you want to use this terminology. So it's kind of, the conversation there is not easy, but it feels like, I mean, for instance, in my previous project, I work a lot with anthropology, ethnographic literature. Yeah. That's a little bit more of a stretch. And it has its own complexity, but likewise, it was an extremely enriching way to, because any time we step out and we really commit to go deeply into this, the working of these other fields, we end up discovering something new about ours.
Yeah.
Or at least we reformulate some of our assumptions in our field.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I think that's actually what's in my experience now, three decades has been, this has always been the most fruitful way I've been working.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your previous work, so this is your book, Having the Spirit of Christ.
Yeah.
And in it, you give credence to the idea that spirit possession in early Christianity deserves more serious treatment as an actual phenomenon than scholars have traditionally given it. So can you talk about that a little bit? Or
yeah, no, this was... this is the initial observation. What actually spurred me into this project that resulted in the book. I noticed, I mean, this is not maybe a earth-shattering observation, but it was kind of nagging at me because I told a lot. I normally teach a lot on the Gospels, the canonical Gospels and also non-canonical ones, but teach also about the historical Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so this has always been a very interesting field for me. But one thing that would always nag at me was the fact that, for instance, when we think about the historical Jesus, or I don't know if you have familiarity with historical Jesus scholarship, which is enormous, you can read through millions of books at this point. Millions is maybe too much, but hundreds, thousands of books. Yeah. And there are very long treatments and very sophisticated discussions of Jesus teachings, mm-hmm. like the sayings of Jesus, the parables of Jesus, everyone has something attached on this. Instead, the other the more practical, if you want, activities of Jesus are almost non-treated.
Yeah.
Like in a classic book like E.P. Sanders' book on Jesus, which is a landmark book from the 70s in historical Jesus research, this book is basically entirely about Jesus' teaching, and this is in keeping with the traditional scholarship on it. It's not that E.P. Sanders is actually a giant, but this is interesting to actually look at that. And the exorcism of Jesus, now since we are speaking about this, is only treated in 10 pages in the entire book, which is, 300 pages.
Yeah.
So it's a remarkable imbalance. Because if one reads these Gospels that narrates the story of Jesus, Jesus does, teaches stuff and speaks and tells parables and so, but he's also exorcising a lot of people and then doing other healing miracles and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think this is kind of a basic observation. There's an imbalance in scholarship, but it's a symptom of the approach that scholarship has had to this specific problem of Jesus, but I think more largely it tells us something about how our scholarship of early Christianity has operated.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is not, there's nothing wrong with this, but it's important to recognize this, that, this scholarship is the historical critical scholarship I was trained in and most of us practice was generated in Europe in the 18th, 19th century on the basis of a very rationalistic, enlightened paradigm of what religion is supposed to be. And I would add probably also Protestant assumptions about that religion is a kind of an individual experience, it's mostly an intellectual experience, inward, interior experience. Yeah. And these things like possession phenomena or exorcisms are things that do not really belong to religion, especially, you know, this definition, of course, of religion depends on a certain understanding of Christianity, because yeah. Christianity is the religion within this paradigm. But even within Christianity, this phenomena, which are very well present, there are attested at all historical moments in Christianity, are marginalized or are treated some usually as exotic or romantic and certainly not belonging really to Jesus, because, you know, as a foundational figure. So this was the initial observation for me. It nagged in me this imbalance that I saw as a shortcoming in our scholarly understanding of this historical moment, Jesus, but not only Jesus, kind of nagged me. And for years, I tried to kind of find a way to actually get back to it and find a better way to address this situation or to address the imbalance. So I have to thank my wife, because she's an anthropologist, Giovanna Parmigiani, and she said to me one day, I remember she told me, "Why, you should look at ethnographic literature on possession, because it is very sophisticated. That's an extremely sophisticated conversation that goes on basically, it's going on basically since the beginning of anthropology as a modern discipline in the 19th century with various permutations, various paradigms." And that was the move that actually opened it up for me. I mean, in the same vein in which we were talking about before, right? You know, looking at another field and it took me a long time to actually familiarize myself with that conversation, because, like I said, it's very complicated. It's very sophisticated.
Yeah.
But it's also enormously rewarding, because it allowed me to then have some tools, some ideas that, you know, I could take back, and this is the comparative move, I could take back into the study of New Testament or the quest for the historical Jesus or study of Paul in a way that illuminated aspects that had before been, I think, difficult to see. So, but using this kind of metaphor could be, you know, using a light from outside would actually put in relief things that were otherwise hidden.
Yeah.
And especially forced me to think that what was needed was the kind of change of paradigm and assumptions that I was describing before, that the kind of enlightenment assumptions about what religion is, how religion works, was unable to capture this. The problem was structural. I think it is structural, that the paradigm of historical criticism is inherently unable to capture this kind of phenomena.
Yeah.
Because these phenomena have to do with this possession is inherently a phenomenon that touches on the identity of the individual and is enlightened. And one of the cardinal rules for this European enlightenment is that individual human beings are inherently buffered. There are no entities that can't be taken over. Their interior space cannot be taken over by exterior forces, right. Exterior entities.
Right.
That's a kind of ontological, anthropological definition that is basic to European modernity and kind of continues to be, I think, the reigning assumption. Mm-hmm. But on that basis, there's no way to comprehend properly a phenomenon like possession.
Yeah, and when historical criticism does their thing on the Gospels, it's not even a question. You know, that the miracles just get put to the side because that doesn't fit into the questions that you're asking. Interestingly, I mean, what most people think is the earliest Gospel has very few teachings of Jesus.
Yeah.
And much more, this Gospel of Mark, much more
stories. Yeah, it's almost only miracles and exorcisms.
Yeah, exactly. And that's tied directly to the claims of authority and the juxtaposition of power and suffering and all of that. So it's missing one fourth of the canonical gospels, basically.
Yeah, but also Matthew, Luke still do a lot of work with that.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, they kind of rearrange stuff compared to Mark, and definitely they are already marginalized this aspect of Jesus' activity.
Yeah.
If one wants, but still they retain it, meaning that it was at least was considered very, very important.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and John too. I mean, the signs are so key to understanding what's going on in John.
Although John doesn't have exorcists, which is one of the big questions.
Yeah. One little blip on the radar screen, right? So you're moving into some new work now, and this current project is on apocalypticism and apocalyptic literature. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Or
yeah, it's. It's a different project. This is really different from what I've done before. As I described, you know, my previous work, it's always been historical, or at least concerned with reconstructing or placing the text we have in their original historical context and negotiating around that. This is a very different project because I've always been interested in apocalyptic literature. Mm-hmm. And there's fantastic work that's been done now by many colleagues and scholars on apocalyptic literature in the Second Temple Jewish space and beyond, and in early Christianity, and how that this genre begins and changes through the. So there's a lot of work going on in that context with those goals. For myself, I'm more interested now in the reception of this rich archive of motifs and images that is created in this kind of formative moment in the Second Temple period or in early Christianity and early Judaism. And from there, it becomes like a legacy really foundational for Western European modernity, before modernity, for the Byzantine period in the Middle Ages in Western Europe, and then into modernity, and because of, you know, of course, European colonization kind of is then imposed or spreads all over globally. It's especially interesting, of course, because this is a kind of an obvious observation that these motifs, this archive of images or this imaginary is now kind of all over the place in our popular culture. But not only there, it's used or invoked almost continuously in political conversations or in even in scientific conversations that we are having about, I don't know, artificial intelligence, especially now, also climate change. Now it's a kind of a traditional association between apocalypse and climate change. Mm-hmm. It's become like almost solidified in our mind. So it's a topic that lends itself quite well, I think, to a study of the long durée of these ideas and how they have changed, of course, but also how they have persisted and how they play out in our contemporary discourses.
Yeah, I'm teaching a course that has, it's called Jesus in History, Art, and Culture, and we're spending this week talking about Christian nationalism and one of the texts that I gave them. So there's this idea of you know, Jesus's dominion being now claimed to be eternal in the ancient world, but people now are picking that up again to claim that this is the Jesus that drives political discourse. And so his dominion lives, therefore we as followers need to, you know, carry that through. And it's right out of the book of Revelation, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah, Revelation especially, for obvious reason, I think it's a text that fascinates because of its ability to, and this is, I think, different from other texts included into the New Testament as well, and this is a striking feature that really interests me, because, you know, Pauline letters, Gospels have had, enormous reception histories. But they are, I think, easier to cage into their own historical moment.
Yeah.
This is always, you know, kind of going back again to the Enlightenment project of historical critical analysis of this text has been to say, okay, let's take, the Gospel of John. And it's used theologically, but now we can actually put it back in its historical original moment. And that's so a way kind of to sort of cordon it off from contemporary. It's much more difficult. It's proved much more difficult to do that with the Book of Revelation, because I think the very nature of the text, it's imagery that is kind of always unclear about its reference. It's always metaphorical in a kind of hidden, mysterious way, kind of lends itself to this is what we can see in the history of Christianity and beyond, lends itself continuously to new updates.
Yeah.
To be updated to the, and it's almost impossible to say, we think we know that this was composed, I don't know, at the end of the first century CE. And you know, for instance, think about the famous reference to the beast with the seven heads, later called the Antichrist, and the number of the Antichrist, 666.
Yeah.
Right, we know that's a reference. We think we know that that's a reference to Nero, the Roman emperor, who had been emperor a little bit before the composition of the text originally. So we think we have kind of managed to put back the text in its historical context. But then again, Antichrist and the 666 continuously is reapplied to, has always been reapplied to contemporary circumstances and often individual figures.
Yeah.
And still that's going on.
Yeah.
And I think it feels like it's unstoppable. And with that kind of the activity, the way in which this text, Revelation, is activated, it's remarkable. And carries with it all the ambiguity of the text. Because as you were saying, it is, for instance, for people interested in political sovereignty, like you were mentioning, it's a text that, you know, it can be read as the most critical of any political power.
Yeah.
As political power, any political power is negative, is kind of, one could read the text has been read that way, right?
Yeah.
That it's a very anarchic text. On the other hand, it's also been read in the opposite way, as a text that founds grounds the most, even totalitarian sovereignty, forms of sovereignty. So it has this power, and it's a very ambiguous power, which is fascinating.
It is, and it's, you know, the thing that when I do teach the Book of Revelation, it's that I try to get the students to struggle with is both the extreme language of political power and of God's, you know, domination and so forth on the one hand, and the hope that comes with that. You know, by the end of the book, there's this, you know, city coming down from heaven, and it's a beautiful city, and everybody's going to be all welcomed into it and everything.
Well, not everyone.
Yeah, not everybody. But then on the other hand, it's extremely violent as well.
Yeah.
And I always try to get my students to think about that pairing of power and violence, but then also the power of historical criticism and putting it in its historical context is that the original people writing and hearing this stuff were not powerful at all.
Yeah.
But then when you transplant it to a group that is powerful, then it becomes extremely dangerous, you know, and very flexible in that danger, you know, in that powerful group's hands to do all sorts of things. And we've seen that a lot of ways through history. And
this is also a fascinating ambiguity of the text. And I think this extends a little bit to all these apocalyptic texts, because they are predicating on this dualism, this distinction between few people who are good and so destined to salvation, and few and many others, all the others, who are bad or somehow destined to damnation or to defeat. It's a powerful rhetorical device, and as you said, we have seen that activated so many times in history. It is, you know, scholarship on it. And this that has observed this has often understood the origins of either apocalyptic texts or apocalyptic ideas or movements as reactions to situations of oppression. This is, you know, something that is routinely, as you were saying, applied to understanding the origins of a book like Daniel or Book of Revelation, kind of Christ movement adherents being persecuted by Roman authorities or at least being oppressed by Roman authorities. Persecution may not be the right word. But then again, because it's a text, it generates. It's not necessary. So this paradigm sees the production of the text as the reaction to the oppression.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, historically, this can be seen. It's true. But the text can also generate, as you were saying, the feeling or the conviction to be oppressed, even though objectively, and I'll come back on this adverb, objectively, a group may not be oppressed, really.
Yeah.
This is, you know, as a student, I always say, you know, this is, you can only look at the U.S., right? You know, where I can say this because I'm not American, or maybe I shouldn't say this, I'm not American. Anyway, we can edit this out of the conversation. It's, you know, you have here white, male, you know, a group of people who are perhaps the most privileged ever in the history of humankind.
Yeah.
And they feel like they are oppressed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
in large part because they read this text.
Yeah.
And that's remarkable. And again, it raises very interesting historiographical questions, questions about religion. Now, religion, what is religion? How religion is produced, and conviction is belief is how is that produced? And also, you know, going back to the adverb, as I promised, you know, what it means to be objectively oppressed? Who's going to measure that? These are incredibly interesting questions, intellectually and scholarly, but I think they have the extreme evident impact in our day-to-day life now with culture and political things we see.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's extremely interesting, and without blowing our own horns here with the importance of our field, but it's, you know, without a deeper understanding of that, it can just go off the rails really quickly. And and an appreciation of how it's not just like this is a phenomenon we need to study in the world academically or intellectually, but that these are people that are fully committed and fully bought into the worldview that comes out of that sort of appropriation of the text, and not just putting them off to the side, saying that's a religious, you know, marginal group, but they're not.
We have tried it, and it doesn't seem to be working very effectively or very productively. So I think, and this is, you know, we can toot our horn here and say, you know, we are people who do religious studies have something very important to contribute to understanding this, not only the phenomena but also the people and how people. This is something I carry over from my previous work on ethnography, for instance. I think that, you know, we have something to say, for instance, about how beliefs or convictions of this type are not just beliefs in the sense of, you know, subscribing to a certain specific statement about, you know, whether we are premillennialist or postmillennialist or things like that, but they also have an emotional component, affective, we could say, component to them, that is important to keep in mind, because, you know, one of the risks of traditional academic approaches to something like that is to kind of reduce this to kind of statements or statements of beliefs and stuff like that, which is true for some people, but for the majority, probably not so much.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end of our time, so I like to ask this last question of all of our guests. So for all the grad students and recent PhDs who are struggling to find their way in academia, do you have any advice or thoughts for them?
Terrible question. Especially these days. What advice? I think before the advice, I would say, you know, I hug you. I want to express total sympathy. It's such a tough time to be thinking about committing to something like that. And we have talked so far so much now about how important it would be to actually have more people working in this field, but it's so difficult. I would say that there are two two trends that are going on as I see it, apart from the scarcity of resources, which I'm not going to speak about, but two trends that I see happening that I think we need to keep in mind, or especially people starting into the field should keep in mind. On one hand, there's this expectations or privileging of interdisciplinary work. Mm-hmm. So I think if anyone is starting in any of the humanities fields, I think, but not just restricted to our field, they should think very much about developing more than one field expertise. Mm-hmm. And this could be, you know, for someone working in New Testament studies, could be work also on papyrology, or work also on epigraphy or inscriptions, or mm-hmm. something like that, that could then become another thing you can do if you move on into a job afterwards, or onto the job market. Now, most graduates, you know, for instance, our graduate programs, kind of everyone is actually invited very strongly to have a secondary field besides religion. And I think that's a great idea. These other fields, I'm thinking about papyrology because I'm more familiar with that. Papyrologists are also disappearing.
Yeah.
So papyrologists are happier than when I was a student. They kind of had a certain way to keep their field under wraps and separated from. But now they're realizing that if they do that, their field is going to disappear.
Yeah.
More quickly than New Testament studies, for sure.
Right.
And so there's willingness to cooperate on that side too, on others. So usually there is willingness to cooperate in most other fields. So there's, you know, I would give that as a first piece of advice, kind of think seriously about interdisciplinarity in this sense, kind of developing from early on, because then it's easier to do that at the start, kind of developing real expertise in another field.
Yeah.
Later, it's more difficult.
Right.
The second advice would be, while you are going through graduate studies, also try to think about a plan B mm-hmm. for your future career. The system, at least as it is in the U.S., and this may be different in Europe. Think, for instance, you know, attendant to that, as a digression, people should also think about going elsewhere to do, mm-hmm. For instance, doctoral work. Mm-hmm. Because that is possible, and there are good programs that are also outside the U.S. And in the U.S., for instance, in our field, talking about this before, like, you know, the programs that really do biblical studies are becoming fewer and fewer. Yeah. So having an expansive view of this, of the possibilities, I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
I would give that as a kind of sub-advice. But the main advice was to say, yeah, while you're going, especially if you are in a master program, that's shorter, so it's not the same. But the doctoral work in this country usually entails 6 or 7 years commitments, and that's a long time. And, you know, no one responsibly, I not certainly in my school, we can promise anyone a job after this 6 and 7 years, and a stable academic job.
Yeah,
that would be, you know, a lie that I don't want to. I absolutely don't want to give. So, you know, everyone should think, yeah, I'm working in this field, but at the same time, I'm also developing a plan B that can be, you know, I've had students, of course, you know, in our feel sometimes students kind of become ministry work in the church, so that's a legitimate plan B.
Right.
But also sometimes they do work in editing, in editorial work in publishing houses. I have it because I work with Harvard Theological Review, for instance. We do have usually doctoral students who serve as assistant to the managing editor for the review, for the journal, and they. Couple of them have been hired by publishing houses after that, because that constitutes kind of good expertise that can be translated that way. So, I mean, I would say, commit yourself to the field you want to be in. Develop some sort of interdisciplinary, distinctive expertise, and also think always about plan B.
Yeah, great.
Well, thank you for your advice. Hopefully there's people listening that will take it. And thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Steve. It was great to be here.
This has been a production of the Future of the Past Lab at the University of Minnesota's Department of Classical and Near Eastern Religions and Cultures. Our recording engineer is Jonathan Prestrud at the College of Liberal Arts Language Center at the University of Minnesota. Visit futureofthepastlab.com to learn more about how we are rethinking the legacies of injustice in the study of antiquity. If you wish to support this podcast and the work of the Future of the Past Lab, click on the Donate button on our website.